Welcome to Everybody A, Everybody Gay,
a queer exploration of Pretty Little Liars.
With your host, Speak Pirate, aka Joanna. I'm here, I'm queer, and I have a cat named Spencer.
And your other host, LCO123, aka Vina, a proud member of the Church of Vander Jesus, who is finally back in our midst.
Well, hello and welcome to She's No Angel. This episode sees the return of our dear Vander Jesus, the rising of Leslie Stone as the suspect of the week, and a 9-second tribute to the heteropatriarchy in the form of a kiss between alien waif Allie and Lorenzo, Hannah doing battle with Leslie as Mona's ex-wives nearly come to blows, and a lot of just creepy atmospheric work.
I think this is probably one of the most skippable filler episodes of the entire run of the show. Like, this episode is deeply inconsequential. You can just feel them running out the clock at certain points. Like, the whole first 3 minutes is just a dream ballet because, like, we have some time to fill. And I guess Maddie Ziegler was on set that day.
Yeah. You're not wrong about that. I mean, I feel like PLL is, like, kind of, it's infamous for the filler episodes, but yes, you're right. This is definitely one that you could not watch it and just, like, you would probably never even notice that you had missed it. Like, if you just didn't watch that week. Yes. Whereas I missed, like, one episode of Angel during the days of live television and was confused on, like, three plot points for years. My sister kept having to re-explain them to me, and I was like, I never saw that episode. I don't know what you're talking about. I think you made that up. And then later when the DVDs came out, I was like, oh, got it. Okay.
I mean, good serialized TV, I feel, should be that way. Like, every episode should be a must-see, but, you know, not so much with She's No Angel.
Yes. We do see the continued estrangement of the liars playing out here. Allison has no scenes with any of the liars this week. And Hannah and Spencer are the only ones who really interact in person outside of the big mystery meetup at the end. And this episode also, it kind of marks the start of one of the real hallmarks of this half season, which is the kind of Spanna detective agency pairing.
Yes, yes. The Spanna Detective Agency is a lot of fun. I really think Hannah is the MVP of this episode, and I feel like Ashley Benson's reactions are holding this episode together.
You know, it's so interesting to watch Ashley Benson in this half season because my biggest takeaways from the time jump is that towards the end of the seasons, it really feels like Ashley Benson is just phoning it in. And it's really interesting to see how engaged she still is, even as we move through this part of season six. She is, like you said, the MVP of the seasons. And it seems like, I don't know what it is. I don't know what it is that causes her to check out, whether it's the bad writing, whether it's the transphobia, whether it's the de-gayification, who can say. But yeah, she's definitely still putting in some really great work at this point.
Clearly, she just wanted to be home with her sex bench. I think takeaway.
Who wouldn't? Who wouldn't? So we open on Spencer wandering through an abandoned building as water drips in the background. It's ambiguous as to whether this is Radley or the dollhouse, which is kind of a shrewd way of underscoring the connection between the two. Spencer's having flashbacks to the dollhouse, to being covered in blood. And at the end of a long hallway, a wraith-like creature appears. She's a girl and she looks not unlike a younger version of Spencer herself, even though she's played by Maddie Ziegler and not Troyan. Spencer follows her into a room full of bathtubs that is very reminiscent of where she ghost waltzed with Allie. This girl is doing a dance full of jerky and somewhat unnatural movements. She's effectively creepy. She's like the ring girl kind of meets the broke neck lady. Spencer keeps trying to interact with her, and it seems like she might even be worried that she's hurt her, but this girl's in, you know, a world of her own. She has some movements that even look a little like labor, which I don't think was intentional, but it's an interesting nod in hindsight to Spencer being born in Radley. And of course, this is another instance of women dominating Spencer's dream space, as well as harkening back to my favorite dream theory, which is that you are everything in your dream. Your subconscious has created it all. So Spencer is the bathtub, she's the abandoned building, she's both this wounded girl and the unknown thing that wounded her. After the girl disappears into nothingness, Spencer finds a pair of slippers with C. De Laurentiis written on them, as if this is some, like, weird Cinderella quest now. It is also unclear in the moment if this is or isn't a dream, as a shadow kind of looms in the hallway and Spencer startles. I really like this opening. It's creepy and it keeps you off balance, and it sets, I think, a good tone for this period of all of the liars being a little off balance as well.
Yeah, I think it's totally an effective bit of, you know, it works. It's an effective, creepy little set piece here. I think I'd like it more if it mattered more in the greater scheme of things. It's interesting that Spencer's dream space is not misgendering A here by just using C. De Laurentiis instead of dead name. But my note at the end of all of this is, well, we ate up 3 minutes.
I mean, I think that you are not wrong about that. It's also a shorter episode than a lot of the other episodes. This one clocks in at just like 41 minutes and like 3 seconds or something. So it's a good deal shorter than like a 42 or a 43 minute one that we often get. So even with all of the filler all the scenes from the cutting room floor that they could like throw together, it still winds up being a little bit short.
It does. So post credits, Spencer is relaying this nightmare to Aria, who insists that it was just a dream. It doesn't mean anything. Spencer suggests that maybe this was a room from the dollhouse and asks Aria to recall if you know, anything about it is familiar. But Aria really quickly shuts this down. She says she can't go back there. She doesn't want to think about it. Throughout this scene, Spencer is munching on it. It's sort of hard to tell if it's like candy or cookies. She'll have her little bag of edibles throughout the episode. She grumbles a little bit about the fact that Veronica is on her case for, I guess, accepting the nomination to be valedictorian, which Spencer declares a pity toss, considering that she spent a month out of school. Spencer tucks her edibles into her school bag and hurries off to escape a post-curves Veronica, who is apparently very fired up and ready to spar.
Now, remind me, do we, like, we never see the liars graduate, so we never hear Spencer make a speech or anything.
No, I think that there is a further reference to her being valedictorian or somebody being valedictorian. But no, we never see the liars at graduation, which is odd because the way that they're talking about it in this scene makes it seem like something we are going to see.
Yeah, it really does.
A thing that I want us to keep track of as we're going through this is my working theory is that they were running out of money when they were making a lot of this half season, because we had talked about, like, I think it was the last episode where it was like all these things they could have shown us, but they didn't. And like, we're not going to see graduation. We see very little of prom. Most of prom, the liars are like literally at home on their phones. I feel like maybe the show was like on a bit of a strapped budget for this half season.
Oh, that is so interesting. Yeah. And I think that could also be part of why we're not getting a lot of like all the liars together scenes. Like if they're not really gathering everybody in the same place at the same time, that's interesting. Also, I'm going to say about this scene, how times change in terms of the way that the liars interrogate their dreams. Remember when Hannah is going to dream that Noel Kahn pushed that girl down the stairs, and then it's just canon? And then we're going to have, like, you know, there's somebody on a horse, and they're in a snow globe, and Like, Spencer's dream space, if we're gonna spend time in a dream space, Spencer's is definitely the one to go to, I think.
Yeah, yeah, the liar's dreams. Is it a dream where Mona sings Jailhouse Rock?
It has to be, right?
Is it my dream?
No, she really does sing it. And I do feel like, yeah, I do feel like that has to be somebody's dream.
I think maybe it's Arya's dream. I don't know. We'll get to it. Which also, like, that's pretty gay, Arya, that you're, like, imagining Mona, like, crooning to you in your dream.
Oh, man, we're going to have to see. I don't know that it's Arya's dream. Well, we'll see. We'll see when we get there.
Yeah, we have some time to get there. Speaking of Andrew Jesus.
Right, right. Back in the here and now, Hannah comes into her kitchen to find Mona, our Lord and Savior, Vander Jesus. She's wearing all black with giant sunglasses. So she's dressed in a very Jenna-like fashion for this scene. She seems jumpy and ill at ease, very worried about Allison wanting revenge against her and about the police charging her with a crime for faking her own death. Hannah tries to get her to kind of refocus on the hunt for A, who is still out there. And Hannah is like Mona being worried about Allison at this point, like Mona's been out of town for like several episodes. So she is unaware that Allie has transformed into the passive alien waif Blueberry. So like her worry about Allison, it's like, oh, you know, you are out of date here. Like you no longer need to be like worried in the way that you think you need to be worried. And so Hannah's like kind of trying to explain that. She says, you know, Allie is so embarrassed that she only leaves her house to go to church. Mona scoffs, but Hannah says that Allie is just trying to find a way to move on, as they all are. Mona begs Hannah to go with her to the police station. She can't walk in there alone. And Hannah, being Hannah, is not going to deny this earnest request from her ex-wife.
I do feel like Hannah could be a little warmer to Mona here. But I feel like Mona has kind of the energy in this episode of, like, you know, the very concerned, like, femme fatale in, like, an old detective movie who just, like, comes into the, you know, detective's office and is, like, tearful and concerned and sort of withholding and, like, instantly, you know, wraps the detective around her little finger. Like, I feel like that is the game that Mona is playing a little bit with Hannah here, because, like, I think she is genuinely concerned, but she's also, like, putting on the drag of being concerned and clearly enjoying that a little bit, which I find very fun.
Yeah, I agree. Hannah is her makeup is fantastic in this part of the episode, but her styling is very, like, kind of like Hitchcock icy heroine.
Yes. Yeah. So maybe they're like two halves of a Hitchcock heroine here.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that there's a later scene where I feel like she's very Tippi Hedren. So
I could see that. I could see that. So Allison, who's going to be a real drag this episode, she is laying on her couch deep in her depression. She is overhearing some cops who are apparently like throwing their voices or something, because they're like way far away from the house, but she can hear them perfectly clearly. They're talking about how she's a skank, how they're the ones who need to be protected from her. She just kind of listens to this, and it's like the Rosewood PD, everybody. But this episode does such a weird thing with the whole like Allison reputation thing, where it's like they're sort of acting like, yes, these cops are jerks, but like Allison's sort of getting what's coming to her in a way. And I do not like that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they call her a skank. They say that she should be chained to her bed. Yeah. I feel like even though we later hear that Toby's out of town, so one of them is not Toby, you know, maybe not, but he would not have disagreed with them and he would not have shut them down. I feel like he would have laughed and chuckled along, because that's just how Rosewood cops do.
Maybe added a few sinister comments of his own. Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So Sarah Harvey is talking on the phone to her mother, who she says is slurring her words. Emily, fresh out of the shower, comes in. Now, is there a rule for the two of them that one of them always needs to be just in or just out of the shower this season? Is this like the only way the writers can try to build sexual tension, is to have like one of them be slightly unclothed around each other in every single scene? unknown. But anyway, Sarah needs to go deal with her mom, and Emily just like puts the pedal to the metal of the U-Haul here and is like, but wait, what if you get legally emancipated?
And as with most of their scenes, specifically their scenes in Emily's bedroom, this scene is cut at a really weird place. Like, I feel like all of their scenes are like cut to ribbons. Also, assuming that Sarah is not on the phone with her mother, is her getting legally emancipated? Do we think that that's like, do we think that Charlotte is trying to make this happen? Or do you think that Charlotte is basically just saying, like, get as close to Emily as you can and the emancipation ends up being part of it? Even worth considering?
I mean, I have no idea. I have a lot of questions about the Sarah plot as this episode moves along and gains steam. I really don't know. But to your point about the way that all of their scenes are like cut in weird places, I feel like every single scene ends with them staring at each other unspeaking. And it's like, I don't know, what are we supposed to think? Are we supposed to think like, oh, these queer women are so in tune that they're communicating via like telepathy at this part? Or are these just two people who so frequently run out of things to say to each other that they just like stare instead?
Well, and it'll frequently end with one of them asking the other a question. Like a few episodes ago when Sarah was like, what do you think of my haircut? And Emily just stared. And now it's like, Emily's like, what if you got emancipated? And Sarah just stares. It's weird. I do have to say, I feel like this episode, like Sarah Harvey's look is like a little bit, like it's becoming a little bit more cohesive. Like she's got more like black eyeliner on. And I feel like they've kind of figured out how to style her hair better. So, you know, you got to give Sarah points where you can.
Wherever you can. That's wherever true.
So Arya is hanging out at Byron's office when new character Clark walks in. It's weird because it seems as though they've only interacted in the time we saw them in the past episode. And they've certainly not interacted enough for any of the other liars to know about Clark. Yet Clark seems like oddly quite familiar with Arya, which, like, is it bad writing? Is it a bad undercover cop? Who's to say? But he's very much acting like they're buds, as he says that he needs to rethink his photos, and he invites Arya to come shoot with him at a junkyard. To which I ask, is part of undercover work taking an underage girl out on a date to a junkyard? Clark just kind of casually drops that there's this photography fellowship coming up, and oh, Arya's work is just what they're looking for, and she could get sent to LA, and Arya, who is very much into the idea of leaving Rosewood, says that she will join him.
I think this is hilarious planning on the part of the police. Like, they're like, hey, let's see if we can get one of those kidnap victims to go to an abandoned junkyard and try to lure their stalker out into the open. And Clark is like, guys, I'm on it.
I gotcha. Yeah, when you know that Clark is supposed to be an undercover cop, everything about Clark becomes 10 times more hilarious and, like, dumb.
It does. It really, really, truly does. So, Allison, now outside her house, and I'm gonna do this wearing a mildly queer look, at least for these blueberry times. It's a gray long-sleeved shirt with the number 23 on it. And as I believe firmly in Allison's bisexuality, I feel this could be either an homage to LeBron James or Maya Moore. So the queer mood is boosted by her moodily drinking coffee. Her dad comes out and curtly offers to let her come to his office with him if she's going stir crazy. Like, she's a 5-year-old who's going to go like color pictures in the conference room. She tells him about the rude cops, and he's like out of character in how unmoved he is. Like, he does not seem like super offended by it. He's like, actions have consequences. You have to live with them. And she leans into their middle-aged couple sniping dynamic and throws out a, you should know. He hates this. And then we get an interesting camera shot of Allison from below with the house kind of looming up behind her. And I felt like that was a nice visual of her being a bit of a prisoner as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's for sure the vibe here. She also says that the cops were dissing her, which feels like, come on, Allie, like you can be a little more creative with your language.
She has beef. She has beef with the cops.
She has beef with the cops. She has cop beef. Yeah, it's interesting. To me, it almost felt like they had made the decision in this episode to be like, okay, Ken is the villain, because there's like, he's written very, like there's no shades of gray in the way that they're writing him anymore. Also, my note about this scene is that these two are starring in a production of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf that I do not wish to attend.
You are so right.
So Mona, still in some indoor sunglasses, is now at the brew with Hannah, telling her to hurry and just order something. And suddenly, here's Leslie Stone, apparently summoned back to Rosewood by the police and at risk of losing her entire life because of Mona, because it is now believed that she was an accomplice to Mona's fake kidnapping plan. She's very upset, saying that her whole reputation is at stake. Hannah defends her wife, saying that the plan was never to hurt Leslie. And Leslie snipes about perjury. Hannah doesn't know what perjury means, but she doesn't like Leslie Stone. Leslie snaps that Hannah is a bag of hair, then threatens the Vander Jesus, basically saying that if she ever sees her again or hears from her again, if Mona ever messes with her life, she will regret it. Now, I feel like a thing that is... like, okay, so Mona faked her own death, but also Mona was, like, in an underground bunker and tortured, and, like, none of that was part of the faking her own death plan, and, like, lots of people really did believe that Mona was dead. So I'm not really sure why everybody is, like, so mad at Mona, considering that the plan, like, went off the rails pretty early on, it seems.
Yes, like, Mona could have been killed.
And was very nearly killed. I mean, she was, yes. She could have died in multiple ways.
Yeah, like, it almost comes across as if they're mad at Mona for not being dead.
Yes, yeah, like the sin is that she lied about this, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, Leslie is a jerk. I like that Hannah stands up to her, and LOL for calling Hannah a bag of hair. You are very wrong, Leslie Stone.
She is so much more than that, Leslie Stone.
She's a designer bag of hair. Oh, my goodness. So Hannah and Spencer are at school, and Hannah is just venting about Leslie Stone, who's acting like being questioned by the police is the same or worse as what Mona's been through. So Hannah is calling out that false equivalency. Is that something a bag of hair could do? I don't think so. She's extremely indignant on Mona's behalf and, you know, on her own, as Leslie testified against her, etc. She calls Spencer out on being rude because Spencer is texting rather than paying attention to her diatribe. Spencer kind of half apologizes, but explains that Toby isn't going to be back until Monday, and that's too long. Now, she doesn't actually say that she's texting Toby, so I'm thinking maybe it's her new girlfriend Sabrina that she's sexting with here. But anyway, Hannah tells her about Caleb acting like she's a delicate egg on the verge of cracking. Spencer is, like, throughout this scene, just kind of eating her pot cookies, as if the direction were, Troyan, eat these cookies as if you are a feral possum. And she is knocking that right out of the park. Seeing cookies, Hannah, of course, tries to, like, kind of grab one, and Spencer smacks Hannah's hand when she tries to grab a piece. Hannah then calls her out for seeming kind of buzzed. Spencer denies it, but Hannah actually does have her number in this scene. Also, wouldn't it be nice if anyone was discussing Emily's love life?
Oh my goodness, I have a lot to say about this scene. First of all, you know that I clocked the extremely flirtatious smile that Spencer shoots at Hannah to imply sexting with Toby. Like, I know that that's technically her, like, confirming heterosexuality, but there was nothing heterosexual about that look. Also, there is a very easy solution to their problem. Spencer is horny because Toby is out of town. Hannah is horny because Caleb refuses to touch her. Ladies, you know. It's right there. It's right there. Also, like, I hate how it went from, like, Spencer is, you know, taking edibles to sleep at night to now just like Spencer needs to be vaguely high all the time. Also, like the way that they're treating the edibles is like it's not like you have a bite of it and then suddenly you're just like automatically stoned. Like there's a bit of a time release, and I feel like the writers are like not. It almost feels like they were told to write this storyline, but like it feels like this was written for like a Dare ad or something. Like it's so. First of all, it's just such a like old fashioned reaction to all of this, but it also is like. They're never really talking about what is happening to Spencer or like what this process is. And so it's very strange. It's kind of like the way, you know, that like study aid would be talked about, but like you couldn't actually call it like Adderall or like actually say what the drug was.
Yeah. The whole thing with Spencer and the edibles is bonkers. First of all, we have this like bottomless bag of pot cookies that Sabrina made for her. Like, no matter how much Spencer eats, no matter how many times in this episode she is eating the cookies like a feral possum, she never runs out. Like, it just automatically renews. There are still more pot cookies that she can take. And number two, like, this is actually pretty irresponsible because this is not how you do edibles. Like, edibles tend to be, like, edibles tend to be stronger than you think they are. So, like,
yes.
If you ate one of those cookies, like, all at one time, it would, like, knock you back. Like, this is, you don't just, like, nom on it throughout the day. And also, like, the way that the show deals with, drugs, particularly marijuana, I feel, because that's a drug that, like, has been linked with Jason before. And it's like, oh, no. Pot and alcohol have made Jason have no brain cells and like no memory of anything that has happened to him ever in his whole life. But like here, as Spencer is doing them, they make her horny and give her the munchies. Like it's like she's a vampire slayer. She's hungry and horny all the time. That is what the pot cookies are doing to Spencer Hastings.
Well, and don't forget that, like, marijuana was indirectly responsible for Maya getting murdered because it like, got her sent back to you know, True North.
Yes.
Yeah, it is super weird. I feel like maybe nobody in the writer's room has, like, ever experienced pot before. Like,
that seems so unlikely, but maybe you're right.
I don't know. I like I said, I almost feel like this was like a directive from the network. Like, if you're gonna have Spencer be consuming these pot cookies, these are the circumstances you have to do it in. Also, like, I am just not even really sure what some of the stuff going on in this scene is, because like Hannah drops this line at the end of the scene that's like, well, Dr. Oz says sex is a drug too, Spencer. And I'm like, but it's like almost a comedy line, but then it's sort of played for like seriousness. Or are we just supposed to be like, oh, that's Spencer, she's just addicted to everything? I'm not really sure what's going on. So at the junkyard, Aria is arranging some dolls for a picture when Clark asks her if dolls are her thing. Oh, Clark, there is not enough time in the day for it to be explained to you what Arya's thing is. Arya defies description. She says that she actually finds them creepy, but she is working on embracing the creepy, which feels very Avataria. He tells her about a photo progression that he did all about rotting vegetables. And then he does a kind of slimy thing of taking her picture and then saying he couldn't help himself when she is clearly uncomfortable with that. And then very quickly, turning that into an invitation for a date. Aria says that she isn't dating after this past year. He acknowledges that he recognized her from the news, but didn't want her to feel self-conscious. He sort of apologizes for not having mentioned it. She says that he doesn't have to. I'm not really sure if there's an appropriate way to like bring up to a girl that you've just met that you know that she was held in an underground bunker. But it is interesting to think about this from the perspective of, like, he's a police officer.
Yeah, I mean, is there a right way or a wrong way to do that? I am going to say that not pairing it with wanting to date her would be a better way.
And non-consensually taking her picture.
Yeah. Also, that junkyard is really fancy. There's, like, so much nice metal shelving everywhere and... It's like,
I know, I pretty... was kind of like, I'd like to poke around there. It looks kind of cool.
Yeah, it's like a pretty posh junkyard, I think.
Yeah.
So, okay. So, Blue Bally and Lorenzo are going over a binder, which is apparently related to this church soccer situation that he's trying to rope her into. And like, now it's like morphed into like some kind of church soccer camp that involves like an overnight and just like it. I don't think the show really knows exactly what it's going to be that he wants her to do, but there's a binder, there's this overnight. He is casting himself as her champion. She is still a bit reluctant. I really loathe him, but at least he's kind of trying to engage with her, and, you know, encourage her to like look outside of herself, which no one else in this episode is really doing. His efforts are cut short, however, when Kenneth comes back in and has some cutting words for Allie and ordering Lorenzo out of the house. So the way in which Ken does this, it really makes it seem like he is probably both racist and classist on top of being homophobic and transphobic as well. So it's really a clean sweep for Kenneth De Laurentiis here.
Yeah, yeah, he's terrible. I started referring to Lorenzo in this scene as Lorenzo the Redeemer because his whole role seems to be to try to redeem Allison. This is another scene where I feel like we cut into it at a really weird point. Like, they're, like, mid-conversation in a way that seems odd. Some hinky editing was happening in this episode, I feel.
Oh, I completely agree, especially because the next Allison and Lorenzo scene seems like it is picking up immediately after this scene, but then it ends with Ken driving up in his car. So
and it's at night. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's just like, yeah, it's a huge mess. but also I think like, have you read Alison Bechdel's Are You My Mother?
I feel like I've read part of it.
So a lot of that, like a lot of that graphic novel memoir is to do with like going to therapy, which I understand that like going to therapy is something that can feel like extremely like revelatory to like you when you're going to therapy. But in terms of like drawing and pictures, it's not that interesting to like look at. And I feel like with Allison, and like she's clearly going through some mental health struggles and some depression, it's not like they're not writing it in a way that is like compelling to watch. Like it's just like watching Allie sit around her home.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that that's true. And yeah, it's interesting that they made such a point in the first few episodes of this season of kind of talking about therapy. And then that thread has really been dropped at a time when a few characters could really, really, really use it.
Yeah. Now I felt bad for myself that I got that scene, but I feel equally bad for you because we have another stinker coming right up.
Oh man, the plot line that nobody saw coming, which is Sarah Harvey and Caleb. Caleb, this is like Caleb's, like, you know, like at his apartment / the agency where he explains how to become an emancipated minor, apparently. Also, like, there is something objectively hilarious to me about all of these actors who are clearly in like their mid to late 20s, like clearly talking about being emancipated minors. And then a thing that will happen later that makes it all that much more ridiculous. Anyway, Caleb is walking Sarah Harvey through the emancipation process for some reason. It is also hilarious to me for a teenage character to actually be getting emancipated on this show, considering that none of the characters have parents most of the time. Caleb is warning that this isn't an easy process. He advises Sarah to just maybe go home and wait it out since she's so close to 18, which is really bizarre advice to give to a girl who is like, it's been heavily implied that she's either being abused, neglected, or both at home. Emily announces that Sarah has wasted enough time and every moment is precious in a tone that makes it clear that she's really talking about herself. Meanwhile, I think poor Sarah just wants a shower.
Like, okay, so first of all, I don't know if we knew before this point that Caleb is technically emancipated. I don't think that, I think the show just kind of decided that about him. Number two, he is talking to Sarah Harvey like this is a job interview. He keeps asking her, like, what jobs she's had where she could support herself. And it's like,
yeah,
well, Caleb, what legal job have you ever had? Like when you got emancipated,
fair.
Like you were an illegal hacker, a burner phone seller. Like what is this about? And also the way he's like, nah, just go home and wait it out for a few months. Like, interesting take from a dude who used to live in an air vent.
Right. And from a dude who, like, I mean, he talked about leaving foster homes that felt unsafe and like that kind of thing. Like, I feel like the sort of weird retconning with Caleb is utterly bizarre to me, because like we talked about his reaction to the cops recently where he was like, well, I'm just going to go have a manly chat with them. And it's like, this is not the same Caleb of season two who like hates cops.
Right. Right. So Arya and Clark are taking pictures in the junkyard. Of course, there's a shadowy figure. Arya pursues them until a metal shelf full of stuff nearly falls on her. Clark comes over and she tries to brush it off, but it appears that, yes, A was here in the junkyard.
Bum, bum, bum. Oh, boy. So Spencer sneaks into what seems to be a Narcotics Anonymous meeting. But unfortunately, she has the munchies, which is, you know, tough break here, Spencer. So she's like, you know, clattering around in the background, getting herself some snacks. But sober coach Dean is here and he begins his testimony. Spencer, at this point, attempts to sneak out with some snacks. But Sheldon, one of the group members, announces that refreshments are for after the meeting. I am not really sure what they are trying to communicate in this scene.
No, this is absolute filler. I think that it just wants you to know that Spencer and Sober Dean are in the same place, and Spencer isn't going to be able to get away without him seeing her, because the way that this dude just like cuts across the whole meeting and across like somebody sharing their, you know, story or whatever is like disruptive and really rude.
Well, and the show has not actually done any work of Spencer. Like when they, in season four, when they had Spencer's whole study aid saga, like we really got an inner look at like how Spencer kind of felt about what was going on. And definitely the execution of that storyline was not perfect at all. But you had a lot of like Spencer kind of doubting her own perceptions of things, Spencer sort of realizing that she had a problem, trying to cover it up, all of that. It feels like the show has not, like, we don't know how Spencer ended up here. We don't even know how she got here, actually, because later Dean is going to give her a ride home. We don't know, like, was this just based on the conversation with Hannah where she's like, oh, maybe I do have an addiction problem. Like, Spencer does not get to really speak about this at all. And also, once again, the show is, like, acting like all drugs are exactly the same. Study aid. Anxiety meds, sleeping pills, marijuana, like they're all equally bad, equally harmful, and like equally likely to like lead somebody down the road of a dark addiction. It is just, it's such a like sort of shockingly unnuanced take.
Yeah, 100% agree. So Arya is helping Clark in the dark room, and as she unrolls some of his negatives, she realizes that he may have taken a photo that captured A. Oh, welcome, MacGuffin of the episode. She immediately runs out of the room. Like she runs out of the room as if she is like, I don't know, seen a really big spider or something, to call Emily. We have a hilarious moment where Emily says, who's Clark? And then Arya's like, he's the guy I met at the dark room, I told you. And Emily forbids Arya from telling him about A because she's worried that Sarah will be targeted. I really wish that Arya had responded with, who's Sarah? She doesn't. Emily says that what Arya should do is she should borrow or steal the picture of A so that they can all look at it later. Arya seems to be gearing up for a freak out and quickly hangs up the phone.
Yes. And meanwhile, Sarah and Caleb are like deep in conversation about her work situation. She's worried about the implications of faking a job since, you know, being A's apprentice is like a bit confusing for a resume. But Caleb very quickly offers this girl with, you know, zero life skills or personality a job at his web design company. To which I say, Caleb has a web design company?
Like, a lot has been happening for Caleb. Like, while the liars were being kidnapped, and while we have to feel so badly for him because he spent all that time not knowing where they were and hating Presra, he also apparently got emancipated and started a web design business. So, you know, good for you, buddy.
He's had a busy time of it, I suppose.
Yeah, he's not in school anymore, so we won't even get it in what he did over the summer, an essay.
No, I guess not.
So Hannah has called a meeting with Leslie Stone at the Brew. We get some nice shots of her inside the window with the neon sign in the foreground. She's dressed very, very rich ex-wife. And Leslie shows up apologizing for this morning, and she and Hannah talk about how to have the ability to forgive Mona, a subject that Hannah is somewhat expert in. Leslie casts a few flings at both Mona and Radley, and when Hannah brings up A and how that person is still out there and says that everything seems to lead back to Radley, Leslie bristles and gets coldly aggressive again. It seems like she may have something to hide.
Bum, bum, bum. Yeah, yeah. She's, like, both kind of interrogating Hannah and, like, kind of shutting the conversation down at the real point at the same time. So Aria sends Clark away to check that she did some I feel like so much of this episode is like photography, like, like fill in this solution negatives. But to check the solution that she dealt with the solution so she can steal his negatives. You know, I took the note here that, like, I couldn't remember how the storyline turned out. I couldn't remember if she actually saw the picture of A or not. But I would kind of enjoy it if this was just, like, Arya being weird to this dude who was just, like, taking pictures, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I feel like this is how Arya will be, like, in a world, like, when Arya went off to Boston, like, this is how Arya was when she was, like, dating guys. Like, she was always, like, randomly, like, stealing their manuscripts or their negatives just because.
Yeah, I think that is very fair. So Sober Dean has driven Spencer home, and he also gives her a bit of a preachy lecture after declining to come inside. The way that she invited him inside was kind of like, who knows what might happen. I'm a feral possum eating a whole bag of edibles situation. Then she gives him her pot cookies and asks him to throw them away. He tries to get her to call him maybe. I don't know. He's very dull. He tries to give her a pep talk. Then mercifully, he drives away.
I was genuinely wondering for half of this scene if this was the same actor who played him last time. Like, I was having such intense white male face blindness. I was like, is this the same guy? I don't remember. I think it is.
That is so funny because of all of the random dark-haired men on this show, I have the most trouble identifying Sober Dean. Like, I have watched so much PLL in my life. And one time I was, like, flipping channels. I was, like, traveling. I was in a hotel. There was, like, an episode that was just on somewhere in syndication. And I saw him and I was like, oh, God, who is that? Like, it literally, like, I had to piece it together from, like, the dialogue of what was going on. So, yes, he is an entirely forgettable human.
He's very nondescript. Yeah, he's super snarky to her in this scene, which is gross. But also, like, why is the thought of a, like, legitimate prescription for anxiety medication not being brought up at all? Like, that is just, it's like, that is just seen as, you know, utterly illegitimate. Like, any medication that might touch Spencer's lips is going to, like, end with her, you know, dying in an alley somewhere is basically the way they're acting. Also, Sabrina made you those cookies, Spencer, and I'm gonna say that they were not cheap to make. So, like, this is like, yeah, at the very least, give them back to Sabrina
for sure.
Yeah, no, don't give them to Dean. So this scene actually goes into what's probably the best scene of the episode, which is Spencer looking over at the De Laurentiis house where she sees Mona and walks over. Mona is dropping off a "sorry I got you arrested for murder" card for Allison. She tells Spencer that she's very flirty with Spencer here. She tells her that she looks great, better than the last time they saw one another. Spencer points out that the last time they saw one another, Spencer was being rolled away on a gurney. And Mona says that she looked more graceful, even being rolled. Spencer asks Mona if it's possible that there was a younger girl trapped down there at the dollhouse. A girl who she weirdly describes as looking like a young Allison, even though this girl looked very much like a young Spencer. Spencer describes the room from her dream, saying that maybe it doesn't exist, but she felt like she had been there before. Mona suggests that this probably just lived in her head. Spencer very much needs therapy, which nobody says, but I say. And Spencer kind of walks away, seeming a bit dissatisfied with this resolution. And we end on kind of an ominous shot of Mona, implying that she might know more.
Yeah, I feel like this episode, even though you're right, it is completely inconsequential and just full of filler. It is kind of like showing us the line of demarcation between the liars who are willing to, like, think about what happened in the dollhouse. And those liars are Hannah and Spencer and Mona versus the ones who just, like Spencer tries to get Aria to even, like, talk about it, and Arya's like, nope, I can't, I have to forget that ever fucking happened to me, nope, nope, nope. And Emily is just like, dollhouse, what dollhouse, this is Sarah, my, like, person pet. it's very bad.
Oh no, she is a person pet,
so
she really likes showers.
Speaking of Sarah Harvey has apparently gone through the express lane for emancipation, and Emily is just, like, waiting outside to see how Sarah would like to celebrate. Sarah is thinking they should get tattoos at the tattoo parlor conveniently located across the street from Pennsylvania Children and Family Services Emancipation Express Lane, two minors or less.
I love that, like, a big part of this episode, obviously, Sarah being emancipated, which means by definition, she is under 18. She is not a legal adult. What is the first thing that they are both going to do? Get tattoos, things that you are not supposed to do if you are not a legal adult. Also, how great would it be if Charlotte was like, Sarah Harvey, your mission, should you choose to accept it, is making Emily Fields get an ugly tattoo.
Oh, man. In that case, Sarah Harvey is much more effective than we ever thought.
Yeah, and later Emily is going to want to get, like, the most basic tattoo of all time.
Yes.
So meanwhile, Spencer and Hannah are having a radly date in the basement, minus their third, Mona, who couldn't join them for tonight. Spencer sees a painting of a girl. It's like a flyer poster thing of a girl who looks like the one from her dream. She has a weird, another, like, creepy flashback. There's some more weird flute music. They come to a room that isn't locked, and it is the one from Spencer's dream with the weird bathtubs. She announces that she's been here before, possibly dancing with Allie. Hannah just immediately starts, like, fiddling around, and, like, it's not even really clear what she's doing. Like, it looks like she's, like fiddling around on a shelf covered with, like, bedpans or something, which is, like, gross. And she's, like, immediately annoyed that Spencer isn't helping her.
Yeah, yeah. She knocks over a bunch of bedpans. And also the tub, at least one of the tubs, is still full of water. So I would give those bedpans a wide berth. A very wide berth. That.
Yeah, this.
Nor would I touch them with ungloved hands. I mean, I have a lot of hygiene notes for Hannah, even though this episode was not filmed during the pandemic.
No, I agree. There's, like, a lot of questions about, like, why are they touching things in this room, especially if the only thing that seems like they want are files. Like, it's really weird and disgusting. And yeah. And this is also, like, another weird, like, a dream as a premonition thing, because it's like, this happens to be the room where they find stuff, and it happens to be the exact same room from Spencer's dream.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
I'm so sorry.
You know, it's like, it's this is going to be how it is after the time jump. It's going to be like, we're just like continually drawing cards to see who gets the worst scene and the worst scene after that. And then there's like one good scene in the episode, and that'll be like the ray of light. Like, oh, we get to talk about Spencer flirting with Mona.
Yep.
So here I've drawn a bad scene card. And over at Basic Tattoos R Us, where underage girls can get tattoos when they've been emancipated, Sarah has gotten a tattoo of a bird escaping a cage. I'm like, I shouldn't make fun of her. She's just been kidnapped and everything. But, oh, girl. she encourages Emily to get one of a mermaid with a harpoon. I know a lot of people take that mermaid as a shout out to Emerson and Emily being Allie's mermaid, or the Japanese symbol for courage. Yeah. Yeah. Then at first, so they're like, Emily's like, oh, no, no, my mom would kill me. I can't. And then Sarah's like, well, just get it somewhere that she'll never see. And then Emily's first thought is like, oh, maybe here on the back of my neck, which is like, that is, oh, Emily. Anyway, super bad placement. Then the tattoo artist suggests something a little closer to the good China. Oh, dear.
I don't even know what that means. I don't know. Like, this tattoo parlor is sketchy AF. Like, I don't know what is going on here. I don't know what the deal is with this tattoo artist, but, like, somebody needs to, like, call it in. Call this tattoo parlor in. They don't even put any, like, plastic or anything over Sarah's tattoo.
Oh, my gosh.
Tattoo. Like, I feel like everybody's getting staph infections and, like, you know, like 16-year-olds are getting tattooed here on the reg. Like, it is weird.
Also, like, you really, like, don't get a tattoo that's like characters from like a language that you yourself don't like know. Like, there's issues of cultural appropriation, but also when I was in college years and years ago, one of my friends got a tattoo that was like the Chinese characters for woman and strength. And she was like, really, like, it was meaningful to her. And then someone who was like one of our friends who had like been to China was like, looked at it and was like, oh yeah, that's definitely like, you know, woman, like that's the sign on every restroom door that you go to. And then later it transpired that one of the Spice Girls had her exact same tattoo. And in an interview described it as meaning girl power. So Emily, a little story from me to you about why this tattoo is not your best idea that you've ever had. Also, I don't think we're ever going to see this tattoo anytime that Emily is shown naked, but that might also be because Emily is never shown naked ever again due to de-gayification.
Well, halfway through this scene, good point. Halfway through this scene, I was like, oh, right. The reason that they have this whole tattoo, I was like, this is a weird plot, but it's right. It's so that they can discover the trackers in their necks. But no, she's just like, oh, the back of my neck is tender. And I thought that that was going to be like, then the tattoo artist finds the tracker. But no, it's just like.
No, they don't find the tracker until they're in like the raccoon lab, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. It's bizarre. It's bizarre. So and also just like, I feel like this episode makes the writers of PLL just seem like a bunch of really old, out of touch people, because it's like the reaction, like the way that they're portraying like pot, emancipation and tattoos. It's like, have any of you ever interacted with somebody like under the age of 20? It seems like maybe you haven't. So over at Radley, Spencer finally finds the dead name file. Apparently, all of dead name's organs were donated, so survey says dead. Hannah, unsatisfied with this answer, starts clattering around some more, digging through some more boxes, and inadvertently pushing an entire box of files into a dirty bathtub with maybe a body in it. The effects and the lighting are really not great in this scene, so it's a bit hard to tell. But Hannah freaks out. She thinks she's seen a kneecap. Spencer decides to try to fish it out. She says that it's a doll. And Hannah's like, is it a blow-up thingy? Like, she thinks it's Do you think that there's just like a blow up doll in the bathtub at Radley? Which, like, sure. But no, it's like is it like a CPR dummy or something?
It's like a resuscitanny is what Spencer calls it.
That's
Yes. So apparently for verisimilitude, they've just like submerged it in water for years.
Just to add some extra creep points. Hannah is like the saving grace of this scene and this episode. Ashley Benson's reactions through all of this are so funny. She's just like shrieking and like yelling at Spencer. And she's like, Spencer, if you leave me down here, I swear to God. Like, she's so, so funny. They hear a thunk, which just, you know, increases their concern.
Yeah, I really love the way that Hannah is so afraid it might be a kneecap. Like, the haunted kneecap element is really, like, just pushing her over the edge. And also, like, it is amazing to me, and maybe this does become a plot point later, maybe it doesn't, but, like, the fact that Dead Name allegedly overdosed on pills, but yet their kidneys and liver were being donated.
Good point.
Come on.
Good point. Yeah. And is there, I don't remember if there's ever, like, if there's other, if this file is just completely fake, or if there's some other body whose organs were donated.
Well, the silly thing about this is that we have, we've already found the Radley file. Didn't we find it last week when they were like, when they were like at that warehouse? But like, so there's just like a port in every storm, a Radley file in every corner where they choose to look for one in this particular season. So,
yeah.
Speaking of MacGuffins, Arya is doing a fairly complicated process of backlighting Clark's negatives in order to take a picture with her phone of his picture of A. It's a side view. But it looks like the black hoodie has boobs. Breaking news. She sends a copy of the picture with a text to the others that says, A is a girl? !
Yeah, I mean, the gender stuff at this point is just a cat's cradle of bad.
I mean, it is a whole mess. But also, I do not feel like this picture, like,
no,
it could just be a baggy hoodie.
Yes. Or a, like, slightly, you know, huskier man. Like, there are a lot of explanations for why this person could look this way. Yeah. Yeah, it is bizarre.
It is indeed. Like, I mean, you just get the feeling that they're like, I don't know, that they're like moments away from trying to get like a crotch shot of A. Like, it's going to be like their next big move that they have here.
Yeah, exactly. So Allison comes outside. It is now nighttime. To find Lorenzo on her porch, ready to take back the binder. Allie tries to apologize for her father, because all Allison does anymore is apologize. But Lorenzo understands the manly need to protect your family and does a little psychoanalysis about why Ken is so angry mad all the time. Lorenzo announces that he pulled from some strings for Allison to get a female officer to watch her house, which is like, oh, great, Allison, like, your new prison guard is maybe going to be slightly less terrible to you. You know, what a prince this guy is. This grown ass man then leans in for a kiss. Allison like reciprocates, they kiss for a minute, and then Ken pulls up and Allison rushes inside.
Lorenzo is terrible. And also, he keeps doing a thing. He did it in the last scene where he was like, well, I got the church ladies to all agree that you could coach this soccer camp thing that I'm trying to rope you into. And she's like, none of them objected. And he's like, well, they were really shitty, but I got them, you know, like, they were really shitty to you, but I like you, so they're going along with me. And now here he's like, he didn't like report the shitty cop for being shitty. No, right. He just convinced them to switch, you know, schedules with someone less shitty for today. So he's like, well, I know someone was shitty to you, but I hooked you up with someone who'll be a little less bad. And then he's like, swoon for me, baby. And she's like, oh, swoon. And that's how it's going right now in the land of Allison.
It's bad. It is so, so, so bad.
Ugh, the de-gayification is here. Oh, at the tattoo parlor. Emily is getting a tattoo on her hip. As we mentioned, I don't think we'll ever see this tattoo again. Sarah sees this text from Aria, and after the tattoos are done, she tells Emily that she read the text, and she has seen a girl in a black hoodie as well. She says that they were watching from across the street when they went to Caleb's. Emily, all of a sudden, like, has this weird reaction of, like, we don't want to talk about this out here in the street. No, no, we can discuss it at home. And then Sarah seems really jumpy and then actually physically runs away from Emily down the street.
Oh, that's interesting. I interpreted this as, because it, like, it almost sounds like there's, like, a bar fight or something nearby. And I interpreted this as, like, Emily could tell that Sarah was getting jumpy and, like, wanted to get them out of there. But who knows? Interesting. Who knows? It's, like, not super clear. Meanwhile, they're sort of doing this, like, weird, like, cut back and forth between the two queer dates. And spoiler alert, the non-canon queer couple has a lot more chemistry. Hannah wants to leave Radley, but Spencer wants to know more info about, you know, who Dead Name knew, etc. Hannah makes a remark about, well, there's not a yearbook for Radley. And just like, okay, but how much fun would a Radley yearbook be? Like, I would love it.
Well, and we know that Charlotte likes to crash yearbooks. So she would probably be in there several times.
Exactly. And, you know, Aria would love to organize that photo shoot. I think she'd have a really fun time. They hear some more strange noises and start to get a little more spooked.
Yes, yes, yes. Speaking of, you know, they're about to flee the scene at Radley, and here Sarah Harvey has fled into a creepy alley. She's all upset because Emily and her friends are looking for whoever had them in the dollhouse, and they didn't tell her. Emily tries to explain she was trying to protect her. Sarah is not impressed. She thought they were connecting. How could Emily keep this from her? I mean, I don't think it's a matter of, like, how could Emily keep... It's like, how could Emily have something about her that you don't know? You guys are spending all of your time together staring at each other wordlessly. So, I mean, I agree. It's a head-scratcher. Emily insists that they are closer than ever to figuring out who this person is. But right then, a hooded shadow looms up, and both Emily and Sarah run pell-mell away.
Yeah, I feel like Shay is, like, doing her best to sell the emotions of this, but, like, there's no relationship here to be invested in. Like, we just, there's nothing to care about here. Meanwhile, Hannah and Spencer are arming themselves. Spencer grabs, like a crutch or something to arm herself, and they open a door to find Mona, who says that she'll explain later. They just need to get out of here. She's clutching a file to her chest. At first, they think it's her file. But then when I think it's Hannah who grabs it, they discover that it's actually Leslie Stone's file. She was in Radley for a long time, long enough that she could have known both Mona and Dead Name.
Yes, this is an interesting plot point, because it seems like if Mona wanted to hide this file from them, she would have. She's Mona. Yeah. Like, yes. Even if she's Mona operating at 50%, she's still Mona. So I think that Mona getting, like, quote unquote, caught with this file is just, like, a means of, like, the liars are going to be more likely to trust the information if they feel like Mona was trying to keep it from them, versus if Mona supplies it willingly, they're going to be, like, more skeptical.
Yeah, I think that you're probably right.
So Allie is at home, and she gets a text from Hannah saying that she needs to get over here. There is a major breakthrough with A being capitalized in breakthrough. Allie is getting ready to leave when her dad tries to give her shit about going out of the house. She breezes past him and tosses out a dig about burying her sibling in Aunt Carol's yard, which Kenneth seems legitimately confused about. Also, I really don't know why we have this scene of like, ooh, Allie's going to leave the house and go meet the other liars, because, correct me if I'm wrong, Allison is not there in the next scene where all the liars have gotten together to talk it out.
She is not. She is not. Also, I had a bit of a chuckle at Hannah, like, writing breakthrough the way that the marketing team would, with a capital A. Like, I would not be surprised if they did, like, if hashtag breakthrough was, like, at the bottom of the screen when that aired.
Yes.
So Hannah continues to be MVP of this episode by making a pun about the photo being a bust. And it's Leslie Stone's. Like, I feel like as Hannah's, like... Like, is, are Hannah's jokes being written by, like, a Catskills comedian or something? Like, it's kind of great. Aria and Emily point out that there is no reason for Leslie to take them down, but Hannah's official theory is mood swings. Spencer reveals that apparently Leslie and Bethany were roommates, and the new theory is that Leslie thinks that the liars killed Bethany. I think it's either Emily or Aria who's like, your sister did that. And Spencer is like, no, Melissa just buried her alive, which is a great line. Spencer thinks that this all comes back to dead name. Hannah thinks that Leslie has Mona fooled too. I feel like even for the liars, this is pretty weak, especially with the theory that Sarah was merely a dress rehearsal in gearing up for kidnapping Allison. Hannah suggests that they need to catch Leslie in the act. And the question now is, how?
Now, another thing, like, I know that this is just one of those scenes where the liars bounce a bunch of questions around. Spencer announces the theory that's going to be the working theory until it's not anymore.
Right.
So I understand that this is one scene that's like one of a million scenes that are just like this. However, since they asked the question, why would A have kidnapped Sarah? Let's just look at that for a fucking second here. The theory is it was a dress rehearsal until they could get Allison. Well, I'm going to point out that Sarah Harvey went missing the same weekend that Allison went missing. It was around that Labor Day. However, Charlotte did not take over the A game from Mona until after season two. So she just had Sarah as a hostage all that time with no end game in sight, or the two of them were just like hanging out in her underground bunker playing cards? None of it makes any sense.
No, it's very much a don't look too closely situation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's super dumb. So Mona is on the phone with Leslie, who is in her car in an alley. Woo! Mona says that she tried to steal the file, but now the liars have it and they know. Leslie flips out and yells that she asked Mona to do this one thing and she messed it up. Leslie, do not speak to the Vander Jesus this way. Also, all of this, like, all of this episode's like, file, who's got the file? It's just like reheated leftovers from Jenna's therapy file.
Yeah.
Back in season one.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just really like MacGuffin after MacGuffin at this point. But we do have a great A tag, which is A is making a tiny little Aria wig and making it on a tennis ball.
Oh, yes. Promising us that good things still exist and are yet to come.
Yes. Aria tennis ball wig is a great little image to end the episode on. And that is the episode. That is She's No Angel. Whew. Yeah. This episode was no angel.
Yes, that's true. Also, who is it referring to? Who is no angel? Is it Allison, who the show seems to want to blame for all of her mistakes? Is it Leslie, the rising suspect? Is it Mona, who faked her own death? Like, who is no angel here?
I'm not sure. Is it Spencer for daring to, you know, enjoy a pot cookie? I don't know.
Hmm.
It's a question. Yeah, this is a weird episode. Next week is No Stone Unturned, which actually apparently both Sober Coach Dean and the valedictorian speech come back in that episode. So fun times.
There's something to look forward to.
There is. Any more thoughts on this episode or as we look ahead to No Stone Unturned?
I mean, I think we have already put more thought into this episode than the writers did. So
that's fair.
Yeah.
That's fair. All right. Well, if you have thoughts on this episode, you can, of course, email us at everybodyapodcast@gmail.com. You can also check out our Instagram at everybodyapodcast or send in a rating and review on iTunes. We would appreciate it. We will be back next week with No Stone Unturned. So until then,
take care.